Thank you very much. Let's see if I can get a mouse over onto the right screen here. So this is sort of the portion where it may be now for something completely different. In trying to keep with the sort of the theme of the conference, I tried to relate to sort of axes of scale. I think that I can do pretty well in terms of hitting two of those, distance and time, time scales that operate on things that you just don't see in most terrestrial. Throwing the microphone on the floor. In terms of number, not so much. We've seen deployments of DTNs that range into the tens or maybe hundreds of nodes, and there's getting to be some commercial interest in these things, but we haven't seen certainly nothing on the scales of thousands or tens of thousands. I took some of these slides from an internal presentation that we'd put together. That was actually funded by some of the work in DARPA, and I'll get into sort of what the funding history of all this was. It's rather convoluted, bouncing back and forth between DARPA and NASA, but that's why I have the disclaimer down there at the bottom. I ran them through DARPA's public release so that they wouldn't get upset. And for people who are interested, the full set of briefings that we put together for this was actually, the internal review was actually a lot more technical, going into how some of the reliability mechanisms work, how security works, and those are, in fact, all publicly released, and I can make those available. So this is just the outline of the talk. I'm start with the history and motivation. This is you'll see that this is a little bit schizophrenic, and as I mentioned, that's due to in large part to the funding history and sort of the way this developed. We started out in 97, slightly before I joined MITRE. MITRE got together with NASA and with Vint Cerf through sort of a fortuitous grouping of social networks and talked about what it was going to take in order to really expand the way NASA communicates with things on the surface of Mars. And this was back right around the time, if you remember the Mars Pathfinder mission, one of the first the little rover that was running around on Mars and doing astoundingly well. So this started out, NASA and MITRE went together to DARPA at the time, to the Next Generation Internet Initiative, and said, hey, you guys are looking at sort of, clean slate. What would the internet be like, or what would networking be like if you were willing to sort of, start over or look at, completely new approaches, and, we've got one. And actually picked up some funding from that, which lasted for a while. And then when the Next Generation Internet project ran out, the funding transitioned over to NASA, and NASA was actually willing to pick this up as the way to move forward and support it. And we've since then, it was during that time at NASA, I think, that we actually formed the first IRTF working group. We had two. One of the first one was actually called Interplanetary Internet. And we figured that this was good because it caused people like yourselves who actually know how the internet works and all the vagaries of making things happen to think that we were weird enough not to pick on us, right? We were just, this strange-looking person over here talking about stuff. As we moved on, we got some interest from Intel Research at Berkeley and actually then rechartered the IRTF working group into the Delay-Tolerant Networking Research Group. Which has been relatively successful within the IRTF. We've got, I think, probably five RFCs through with several others that we're going to be pushing through in Hiroshima and after. So I'm going to talk a little bit about, the history motivation, a little bit of technical stuff in DTN approach, just enough to sort of, form the foundation for what I want to talk about in terms of capabilities and protocol mechanisms. And then the future directions is the scaling in terms of number. What would it be like if we could actually scale this up? And there are a number of challenges there. A lot of things would need to change in the way you think about how routing works. How do you think about what connectivity really means? And I'll talk a little bit about that. So this started with talking to not we started thinking about Pathfinder, but this really, you know, has taken off with the Mars exploration rovers Spirit and Opportunity that are on Mars. And there's a real lesson to be learned there. They started out, as all NASA missions do, and in fact, all of the civilian space agencies, massively conservative. I mean, you know, just absolutely, you know, mission managers are given individual pots of money to go do missions. There's very little sort of long-term multi-mission view. The only people that have that are the people on the ground that are running the ground networks. Things like NASA's Deep Space Network, they see mission after mission. But typically, the way missions are funded is to give a big pot of money to one mission manager, have them go out, build this mission, and run it. And also, because of the time scales that are involved in doing things, not necessarily with Earth observing, but certainly with missions to Mars, you get one of those. And that sort of explains some of their conservatism. You're going to get one shot at this. It's going to make or break your career. So when Spirit and Opportunity were launched at Mars, like all good missions, they had direct to Earth and direct from Earth comms. A little high-gain antenna that sits down there and swivels and goes and looks at Earth. And their plan was to use the NASA Deep Space Network, a collection of 370-meter antennas and a bunch of 33-meter beam waveguide antennas to talk to these things at Mars. And there was this little, you know, somebody managed to get an experiment onto the rovers and said, well, you know, you want to talk to these things. That's hard to do. You know, you've got to use S-band. You know, start thinking, I've got the next slide is going to be sort of calibration in terms of what the scales are. It's a long way to Mars. It just is. So somebody convinced them to put a little experiment onto the rovers and onto one of the orbiters and said, well, what if you put this little UHF antenna, UHF radio there? And you could communicate then, you could talk from the surface of Mars up to one of these rover or up to one of these orbiters, and then you could turn around and collect that data on the orbiter and turn it around and send it back to Earth. And wouldn't that be cool? And that would let you do all these things. And they had this whole list of, you know, why this was going to be better, most of which didn't actually get implemented until more recently. But okay, fine. It was an experiment. They were willing to try it. And at the time, the mission operators, the first couple of times they ran through this, said, oh my gosh, I mean, it's a DSL upgrade, back when DSL upgrade was actually a big deal. They said, you know, this is great. All this, you know, a lot more data coming back, and also, you know, power implications. Running the direct to Earth and direct from Earth comms on the rovers costs a lot of power, and mission operators were having to make this decision. Do we drive today? Do we talk today? And it really came down to that. I mean, they just didn't have enough power to do both. And it turns out that it's a lot easier to generate power on orbit than it is down on the surface of Mars, where you've got dust and atmosphere and all sorts of other things. And so this is sort of the beginning of internet working, right? You've got this little local link that's going from the orbiter down to the surface, and you've got this long-haul link that's going from the orbiter back to Earth, and they actually are using different link layer protocols. So, you know, you're starting to get into internet working. They didn't run it that way, and they still don't. The actual framing and the mechanism for getting stuff back is incredibly convoluted because they didn't, again, they were very conservative. They didn't want to change anything, so they weren't really willing to go with anything that looked like a network layer or end-to-end addressing. They were willing to go with, I know how to do direct-to-Earth comms from the rovers. I'll just pretend that the orbiter is the Earth, and I'll send whatever I was going to send to Earth directly, I'll send it, but just framed a little bit differently for this local link. So the scaling and distance, one-way light times, just to sort of calibrate things, pretty much everybody knows the Earth is about 8 light minutes from the sun. It turns out that there are also two stable Lagrange points that are pretty important, trailing and leading the Earth, that are also about 8 minutes away. Those are important because if you want to get around the sun, you can send something to one of these Lagrange points and have it orbit there. And it's the stable Lagrange points, things will tend to want to stay there in space. Geostationary satellites, about an eighth of a light second away, one way. So you pay about a half a second round trip time. for anybody who's operated an ISP that's getting its data across a geosatellite, you know that starts to be an issue. All of the and that spurred a lot of the performance enhancing proxy work that was done like by Hughes and DirectPC and all of the things to try to mitigate some of those problems with TCP. The moon is either really important right now or maybe not as important depending on where you think the Augustine report and constellation is going. But it remains about 1.28 light seconds away. Regardless of what you think the funding is to get there. Transcontinental fiber, I skipped, you know, something, you know, in the low tens of milliseconds. Mars, when it's close, is 4 minutes away. So you've got an 8-minute round trip time. When it's on the other side of the sun, if you could talk to it directly, it would be 20 minutes away. So anything that you're going to do in those time periods, you're going to do, you're going to need to do sort of all of it ahead of time. You know, you've got to be well planned. You got to know what you're going to do, and you're not going to spend a lot of round trips. There's not going to be a lot of chit chat back and forth in order to set things up and do communications that way. And I've got in a couple slides, I talk about why that breaks a lot of, you know, sort of what we do in the internet. So the first of these is you've got these huge delays, and that causes this disruption. Sort of another little bit of history. This started out as purely delay-tolerant networking, because we thought, well, you know, the problem has got to be that Mars is 4 light minutes away. That's really long, and you're going to have problems communicating there. And we really didn't think about the larger problem when we started, which was, yeah, Mars is 4 light minutes away, but there's only 3 antennas that can ever talk to it, only one that can talk to it at any given time. And by the way, you don't have time on that antenna. So this is talking about sort of just the purely delay aspect that says, you know, there's stock TCP would just die. Application layer timers would die. And this sort of was the start of motivating this different way of going about networking. The other cause of disruption is this intermittent connectivity, so scaling in time. The rovers, the exploration rovers right now, return about 98% of their data through the orbiter. They get a little bit back from direct to Earth, but most of it is coming through the orbiter. And the orbiter to lander connectivity, and these are obviously completely made up, but it tends to be a couple of passes in the morning, in the beginning of the day on Mars, and a couple of passes in the afternoon. And depending on exactly where the orbits fall, those things run, you know, in the low tens of minutes, you know, something around 6 to 15 minutes. So you've got a couple of opportunities there, and the people who run missions are really interested in taking advantage of that because it gives them a chance to command in the morning, have something happen, get data back at night, chew on that data overnight, and then command in the morning and go through that. And then the Earth-to-orbiter connectivity looks sort of like this thing on the bottom where you've got you know, a couple of passes per day. They may be 2 or 4 hours. They tend to be a little bit longer. The orbiter's doing its own science, collecting a bunch of other stuff above and beyond just what the rovers have. But in between, you've got these huge gaps. So if you think of trying to close a control loop between the mission control center on Earth and something that's down on the surface, you're trying to actually drive the rover. You know, you've got this round trip time that's looking not just like the 4 minutes of light time to get to Mars, but it's more like, you know, half a day. Because by the time you get your command out and it gets checked and they go through the you know, transmit up to Mars and to the orbiter has to hold on to that maybe until it goes, you know, halfway around Mars since the two rovers are on opposite sides of the planet. You've got all of this time. You have no end-to-end connectivity ever. There's no time when you can take a packet or any kind of, you know, unit of information and launch it towards Mars and actually have it, you know, wend its way all the way down to the rover on the surface using the relay system. And so you get these round trip times that are huge. So this is the disruption causing you delay. Now you've got this case where, if I can point with that, you know, if you're willing to queue data in a ground station, then you can queue it there, but until you get your tracking pass, you're not going to transmit anything. You've got to sit and wait. So the disruption to your link has caused you some delay. And we started out thinking that the delay was the big issue. When we went through the first round of going to the next generation internet, they were willing to buy off on that, said, yeah, that looks good. When we went back to DARPA again after NASA, we were a little bit further along, and they were taking us a little bit more seriously by that point. And if you go to DARPA and you say, we have this really wonderful technology, and we can get data through even when there's delay, and they look at you and they say, we don't have delay. Well, yeah, you do. You know, you've got, you know, all these radios, the tactical radios that are line of sight, they drop it. No. You know, delay is bad. We don't like it. But if you go to it and you turn around and you say, well, you know, what are we going to do about that? So we can get your data through even if you have disruptions. They say, oh, yeah, we have that. Because they know that, you know, there's all sorts of jamming. There are line of sight issues. And so that's sort of how this developed in terms of either delay or disruption tolerant networking. The DARPA PM thought it was a really cool idea to reuse the acronym. That turned out to be stunningly bad. So why do you want to do this? You know, what are the things that would motivate you to look into delay and disruption tolerance? The internet protocols, although they were originally designed for packet radio, have grown up to the point that they're just not going to work in some of these environments. And there are these sort of inherent assumptions that you have this end-to-end connectivity. You know, TCP, ICMP assume that, you know, you can send things and get them all the way through to the other side. TCP's reliability mechanism is assuming that round-trip times are cheap, right? I can actually send something and have you acknowledge it and have me retransmit it if it gets lost, and that's a good way to do reliability. The space environment doesn't meet that. Tactical environments tend to not meet that, a lot of those requirements, depending on where you are. Some mobile networks don't. And an interesting thing, you know, that I've been sort of struggling with lately is, you know, where is that breakpoint, right? If you've got an infrastructure, where you can pull out, you know, a BlackBerry and you've got one-hop connectivity to the network, that's pretty good. The times when this tends to be a win are the times when you can say, well, I don't necessarily have that infrastructure. I've got something that is either completely broken because the hurricane came in and knocked everything out, or I've got one of these space environments or somewhere where you just aren't going to get that infrastructure support. So the first round conclusions when we went through this were, we wanted to be able to reuse internet technologies in places where it made sense. And the glorious vision is at some point NASA or ESA or one of the space agencies will actually launch a fleet of rovers, and they will go to Mars and collect all sorts of interesting rocks and pick them up and play with them and turn them over. And they'll probably want to talk to each other. And for that, if you could get 802.11 or 802.16 on the surface of Mars, great. There's no reason not to take the things that we know and understand and simply reuse them, you know, pick them up off the Earth, drop them down somewhere else and reuse that. And then the thought is to bridge that with this notion of the interplanetary network, this DTN backbone. I'll talk a little bit about, you know, sort of exactly what that bridging means. It does not mean simply taking IP packets and tunneling them across DTN. And that really gets into using gateways to interface between those environments. And it's sort of like impedance matching, right? You think about, you've got these very heterogeneous cases. You've got fiber on the Earth. You've got this long-haul space link. You've got maybe the short-haul space link on the other end. Environments with drastically different characteristics. And if you can actually come up out of the transport layer, if you will, and into one of these gateways, and do the impedance matching, you can tune each one of those segments, whereas you can't make anything work all the way across end to end. And by doing that, you construct this sort of network of internets idea. People remember the game Frogger, right? You were this little frog, and you had to get across all the little logs. This was sort of the motivational picture for why you might want to do this. The top is looking at sort of the end-to-end picture, and I drew this very carefully to make DTN look good. But we've found things that operate like this. And the way to read this is source to destination going across four different links and a timeline going off to the right, and just saying that in the heavy green areas, those links are available, and in the non-green areas, the links aren't. And it's looking at what happens if you try to send a couple of packets down that, you know, down that path. And this is the top part is assuming that you've got static routing and everything is set up so that you even could launch that packet and that you don't have to do a DNS resolve because, well, that's not going to happen over a four-minute delay either. So you may be able to get, you know, one or two hops down the path, but then your packet dies because there is no next hop. No next hop, pitch the packet on the floor. If, you know, somebody really wanted it there, they would have used TCP. Somebody's going to retransmit it. And the bottom is looking at this store and forward notion, where you actually make use of each link as it becomes available. So there, what we're doing is just moving the data hop by hop through the network, and then in the meantime, right? If you send that first bit of data and it can't make it across this next link, well, this node here then has to hold onto it and wait for the next hop to become available, and then get things down. And that gives you a couple of sort of interesting results. The first one is the latency is lower. So we're looking at this at a way to deal with times when we had high delays and deal with intermittent connectivity and have, you know, delay-tolerant networking, and our delay went down. And the second is, and the one that we actually had thought about, was that you get a lot more throughput. So the mechanism for doing this is called the bundle protocol, and I'll talk a little bit about why bundle on the next slide. But the point is that you can take these things, and if you sit up here above transport layer, your application can use this, and you use some transport layer to get across a chunk of the network, and you come all the way up to application layer in the internet model here, and dump down into another transport layer here to go the next hop. The rationale for that really is if you're operating in this very highly heterogeneous environment, and we did some work like this looking at Navy networks where they have airborne layer, and then they have things that are shipped to ship comms, and then going all the way out to Marines and EPLRS radios. Even if you cheat, even if you say, I know what this path looks like, I know what the bottleneck link is, I'm going to run, you know, a pure rate control transport layer all the way end to end, you still can't do as well as you can do if you do this hop by hop. Because if you've got any appreciable error rate in that path, if you try to go end to end, your error rate compounds as you move down the line. And what DTN does, because we can hold on to this, onto the data each one of these hops, you know, the data may go down here. This node, these things are supposed to represent disks and storage. This node may not be able to hold on to something. It may simply forward it to here, but this guy may be able to take that and commit it to persistent storage and say, you know, I can now be responsible for moving this forward in the network. And the goal there is really to maintain the gains that you've got, right? You don't want to be doing retransmissions from the source if the source is a rover on the surface of Mars. If you get something from the surface of Mars up to the orbiter, down to the Earth, through the ground station, you know, out of the ground station back toward the control center, and then, you know, there's congestion on the control center land for some reason and you drop something, you really can't go back to, well, you know, I really like the rover to retransmit that, please. It just doesn't work that way. So instead, what DTN has looked at is using this custody transfer model where you give custody to the network. You turn that over and say, look, I know that I'm not going to have an end-to-end path. I'm going to rely on the network to get the data to the destination. And then nodes in the middle of the network take custody, and there's this custody transfer mechanism that involves sending acknowledgments back within the network. So, you know, this is, you know, a great departure from sort of the standard model of a dumb network and smart endpoints. Here, because you have all of this sort of extra richness in the network has to take some extra responsibility. And that sort of led to this set of design rules. Don't plow the same ground twice. Right? That's what custody transfer is trying to get at. If you've made it across a really rough patch of network, don't go back and try to retransmit from the other end. Don't do unnecessary chit-chat. This is sort of where the bundling name came from. If you look at FTP, depending on how you count round trips, FTP can takes either 8 or 22 round trips before it moves its first byte of data. If you want to set up the control connection and get logged in, FTP is really chatty in that way. So moving that back and forth across one of these highly challenged networks is going to be a problem. Instead, what you'd like would be for the application to say, okay, tell me all this stuff about this file you want to move. What's your name? What are your authentication credentials? What's the file? Where do you want it to go? What do you want to happen if that doesn't work and something breaks? Take all of that stuff and bundle it into one thing and ship that thing across the network one time and then deal with it at the far side. Some other things, don't depend on information that's far away. You're not going to be able to do a DNS resolve. So we came up with, in the first cut, a hierarchical routing mechanism that was essentially a two-stage routing where you said the first thing was, what planet are you going to? Where are you headed roughly? Go that way. I don't know where any of this is, but go over there. Ask him. And then do the resolve down to a specific network layer address. That also lets us decouple things. Mars is sort of an extreme example in that there are launch opportunities to Mars about every 2 years. But we might actually get to the moon and might actually get a significant presence on the moon. And that would be, then you'd have a lot of machines. Because if you've got robots, you've got, an IP address per instrument you could envision. If you've got people, you've got a lot. And so this don't force homogeneity says, we wanted to be able to take internet technologies, move them somewhere else, reuse them, but you can't force everybody to update at the same time. Right? If somebody comes out with IPv7 that actually does accounting the right way and you can charge for multicast and quality of service, Earth will go that way. The moon, Mars, probably doesn't make sense to do that. So how do you do this? As I said, we started out with this hierarchical naming model where the endpoints are actually addressed by name, not by address. So they're these URI formatted names that we originally used to build up these two-part region identifiers where you would say, what region are you in? And then you didn't have to know anything else about, the semantics of names in that region. So that would let you say on Mars you want to go to Earth and here's an IPv6 address. And the things on Mars didn't have to know squat about what IPv6 addresses really looked like or what their semantics were. They just needed to know how to get to Earth. And it was the job of the gateway on Earth to pick that up and say, I know about Earth addresses and I know that this really ought to be IPv6 and here's how it ought to go. So what are some of the simple things you can do with that, right? You can say, format it as a URI, and we've got a provisional DTN URI, my machine / ping, right? Host name and port, which is typically the way a lot of people who are setting up little test examples tend to name things. And ping is actually special in the DTN in one of the implementations. You could envision something that was more hierarchical, something that looked like, Mars Orbiter 8, Instrument 2, and some thermistor, and get at that. Sort of just more levels of hierarchy in order to get down to something that essentially comes down to, a host and a port. But, these things are just names. So you could put a query in there. You could say, I want to talk to things that are, this sensor net out in the Mojave, and I want this bundle, this piece of data, to go to anybody whose temperature value is greater than 20 centigrade. Now, how that actually happens and what the routing has to look like behind it in order to make that happen is a different question. but at least you can sort of start to express things that look like that. So you could say, you know, I want to talk to all the cars on 495 that are going slower than 20 miles an hour, which might be all of them. And then you can start to get into sort of more complex things. You could say, I want to talk to anybody who's within 1,000 meters of, you know, I want to talk to the police that are within 1,000 meters of me that have dogs, whatever reason. I want to do flood routing, and I want to talk to anybody whose battery level is less than a quarter. You know, I want to do, and then even some more esoteric things, you might want to say, I want to route through this DTN network until I get to some spot that knows about mail. Right, how am I going to actually deliver this thing its last hop? I want to go hop by hop using this custody transfer mechanism, and then when I get to somewhere that knows about mail, I want this thing to pop out and send email to somebody, maybe as S/MIME or something. And this is one of the things that's newer within the IRTF working group, looking at what does this really mean, and how do we start to get our hands more around this than just, oh, it's this big string and you can do anything you want. Routing ends up looking really different here, right? IP routing wants to look at what does the network look like right now, build that picture and route on it. And that's part of why mobility is such an issue, right? If things are moving, that picture is changing, you've got to track what that picture looks like, and then use that to forward packets. Because DTN can store things at these intermediate nodes, you can route taking time into account. So you can say things like, I've got a schedule. I know what this schedule is going to be. And in 10 minutes, there's going to be really good connectivity over here in this part of the network. That gives us some flexibility. And that sort of is starting to get into something I want to come back to at the end, which is, you know, if you had a larger deployment of things that were actually trying... actually trying to route on a large scale, how do you deal with questions like, you know, I saw you recently, but I don't see you now. You used to be over there. Are you going to come back there? Or are you going to show up somewhere else? Because you can plan for things like that. If you tell me that you're going to go somewhere else, I can start sending things in the other direction. You know, things that I'm sending to you, if you say, I'm leaving here now, I'm going to San Francisco, I can start sending things toward the... you know, toward the West Coast, so that they'll be there ready and closer to you when you get there. Now, again, if you've got, you know, the internet as your backing infrastructure, does it make much sense to do that? Maybe not. But if you're on a battlefield and you're trying to deal with UAVs that are flying over, picking up data out of sensor fields, maybe it does. There are a couple of things that have been done in this area. There are ports of just regular internet routing protocols, distance vector or link state routing protocols, to sort of inform these DTN nodes. And even then, you get into the beginnings of some of these notions of what to do when things go away. Right? In the simple case, you say, well, I'm just going to make this work the same way internet routing works, and that's fine. In the more complex case, you start to ask, you know, questions like, well, I've got a link state routing protocol, and instead of simply throwing things away when they're not visible, I'm going to keep track of, you know, sort of what the network looked like, you know, 5 and 10 steps ago, and I'm going to try to do something intelligent about dealing with times when the network gets partitioned. So I'm going to keep routing, you know, in the direction that people used to be in, or I'm going to do something to try to make use of some of that. There are a number of probabilistic routing schemes that have been developed that are generally applied to probabilistic things. People were interested in using DTN as a mechanism to get data back off of zebras. They wanted to track zebras and find out what they where they were going, what they were eating, what they were doing. And so there, you've got these things that are moving around completely at random, generally because they couldn't afford to collar all of the zebras. In the game park, they collared, you know, 10% of them. So you've got these things that are moving around, interacting with each other pretty rarely. And then you can apply things like, well, if you have seen the collection, the data collection station more recently than I did, maybe I should give my data to you. And there's a whole suite of things that, sort of operate on those kinds of assumptions. And then you've got sort of, on the other hand, this scheduled routing mechanism that says, I know what the schedule is going to look like, and I'm going to route based on that. On sort of the extreme end of that, NASA has got an implementation of a routing protocol that says, you start with all of the information about what all of the links are going to look like in the future, and then you decide, which of those contacts you're going to lay the data down onto. So you end up with something that looks almost like source routing, in that the source is trying to make those kinds of decisions about where things are going to go. And then, support for database and query kind of support is above and beyond that. This was some of the beginnings of some of that dealing with disconnectivity that we did as part of one of the DARPA exercises. And I pulled this, in fact, out of the one of the PM's slide decks. But here, the notion was you had two on-the-move things. You had two of these Humvees that had satellite antennas in them, and they were running around, in this case, underneath a lot of trees, and that caused the BGAN satellite to lose lock. And you might really want to talk from one of these things to the other if you're doing situational awareness, all the little blue dots moving around on the screen so that you know where your friends are. You might want to be communicating from one of these things to the other. And the problem is that each one of those links individually and somewhat independently are really, really ratty. So they see things, you talk about packet loss. Typically in tactical environments, you see something like 30% packet loss. So, the chances of something getting through two of these links is really small. Sometimes happens, if they're both out and have clear line of sight, but not necessarily. So the trick here was, do some neighbor discovery to find out if you can get directly from one of these mobile units to the other one, and if you can, great. But if you can't, fail back to this battalion node over here on the right. This guy over here has got the tent. It's warm, it's dry, he's got air conditioning. It's good to be in the tent, better than the Humvee. And sort of more importantly, he's got a satellite antenna that's set up with a good clear line of sight to the satellite and no trees. And even if there are trees nearby, they're not moving. So once they get it set up and working, he's going to have good connectivity. So if you can't make it directly from one of these on-the-move units to the other, maybe your best bet is to use to route through this battalion node and say, well, I couldn't get it there straight, but this guy over here, he's got good connectivity. I'm going to go set it over there and let him deal with it. And then, what this shows is, in the second slide, you do that from OTM1 and cache something over here at battalion, and then later you can dump it back. And this was all done by just tweaking a little bit distance vector routing. Right? All this did was it said, when somebody goes away, you don't age them out all the way. You just cause their cost to start creeping up. And because and you cause that cost to start creeping up at a higher rate if you're a mobile than if you're a fixed node. And at that point, you start to, when somebody gets disconnected, that fixed node starts to look like a really good way to get to them. I've got a couple of slides in here that talk just protocol stuff, right? Essentially stole a lot of mechanisms from either IPv, all the good places, right? IPv6, RSVP, so that these bundles are composed of a series of these of what are called blocks. And there are sort of per bundle and per block control flags that you can do all sorts of interesting things with. One of the interesting things is this notion of status report flags. So you can say, I want to know things about when this bundle is traveling through the network. I want the people who receive it to tell me. I want to generate a lot of network traffic, right? Or all the people who take custody of this bundle, I want them to tell me. So you can use that possibly to inform network management and build up this picture of where all of your things are. You think, well, why would I ever want to know where every packet in my network is? For terrestrial networks, no, you don't. This last week, I was over at a standards meeting fighting this battle with the European Space Agency, and by God, they do. Every packet, every file, all the time, where is it? They want to be able to touch it. They want to be able to reorder all of the queues. And oh, by the way, they'd really like to be able to go in to the application data and muck with that while it's sitting in transit waiting to go the next hop. I told them that that was going to be hard. There are, that's sort of the basics of, how do you get from here to there? How can you deal with these long delays and the disconnectivity that comes up? And in the DARPA context, and I apologize for this being somewhat schizophrenic between NASA and DARPA. In the DARPA context, there's a lot more interest in sort of further reaching concepts, you might say. So things like content-based networking. I really don't want to care where the server is. You mentioned things like service-oriented architectures to the Navy, and they say, oh, that's bad. Why is that bad? Well, because we have no bandwidth. There's not enough bandwidth to do service discovery. So what we want is we want to pre-configure all the service discovery. We want to pre-configure where the services live. And you can run down the list, and you can maybe try to find one that works if the one that you normally use doesn't. But there's not going to be any of this big discovery stuff. So one of the things that we came up with in order to support those kinds of notions for still doing something that's content-based is using one of these blocks as metadata that describes what the data is. Right? You've already got this thing that if you're sending a map or an image like this, if you're sending this multi-hop through the network and it's doing this store and forward, well, you're going to have to be storing it at the individual nodes as it goes. You can throw that away once you forwarded it, or maybe you hold on to it and you keep the thing and you keep the metadata with it. And if you have a little bit of extra protocol mechanism on top of that, the next guy who comes along and asks for one of those images, you can serve it to him out of the middle of the network. Right, you don't have to go all the way back to the source. Yeah, if something comes in and says, I want the JPEG image of the rover arm, and if that image has already moved hop by hop through the network to somebody who's out there, and the query comes back and touches one of those routers, and you can match that query up against the image, well, then you can serve them out the data that they're looking for. So we actually did some of this and have looked at doing this in terms of how do you encrypt this data differently? Can you encrypt this metadata differently than the data itself so that you can have people who can search for stuff and find stuff but don't necessarily have the credentials to look at the data that they get? That turns out to be an important thing to be able to do. And also looking at using this to sort of get back a little bit of the granularity of the hierarchical routing, the region notion that we started out with. One of the things that scares me a little bit is if you've got these giant string-based names, what are you going to do when you have 10,000 of those? Can you do a lookup against 10,000 names that are not just fixed strings but these queries? How is that going to work? And so one of the ideas there is to take, is to have some nodes do maybe more processing on these names and provide a routing hint that says, almost like landmark routing or back to the hierarchical routing notion that says, I looked at this and I think that really this wants to go that way for a while. And if you want to look at it, if you want to go through all the trouble of looking this thing up and parsing through the 10,000 strings and doing whatever you have to do, you can do that. Or you can just sort of take my word for it and let somebody down the line, figure that out. And eventually somebody would have to pick that up again and do that, sort of redo that process. What that gets you is it gets you the capability for doing something like fisheye routing or hazy stated link state routing. Just a couple of other things. One of the things that we started out with in this was, an absolute need to incorporate security. One of the things that I didn't mention about the deep space network that NASA runs is that, there are 370-meter antennas, and they're thousands of dollars an hour to run. NASA won't even actually tell you what they cost. It's hard to figure out. But they are expensive. So anybody who wanted to mount a denial, and the bitrate going outbound in the commanding direction from Earth to spacecraft is abysmally low. It's hundreds of bits per second, mainly because they didn't ever need anything more than that. They weren't looking at really closing control loops. And so hundreds of bits per second that was really, really reliable to do commanding was a lot better than a kilobit per second with some loss. But the point is, you've absolutely got to keep the bad traffic off of those links, right? Even if somebody can send just complete garbage across, and think of IPsec, if you're sending to some destination, you can send them packets that don't decrypt, and you've consumed the network resource between where you are and where that where that destination IPsec device is, and okay, maybe that's not a big deal. Here it was. So one of the things that we sort of built into the security protocol was this notion of mutual suspicion of routers, so that you can have a router that says, "Yeah, you can send me stuff, but you've got to authenticate that to me, or I'm not going to forward it." The good part about that is you only have to talk to your immediate neighbors. This isn't proof against somebody getting overrun, right? If they get overrun and the bad guy steals their keys, well, they can start authenticating traffic, and then that traffic can propagate as far as it wants. But at least if somebody comes in and jacks into the network and starts sending out bad packets, they're not going to get more than one hop away. And then there's sort of some, sort of commensurate end-to-end security mechanisms that do either payload integrity or confidentiality. And this extension security block notion is the encryption of individual blocks within one of these bundles. So as I talked about, you might want to encrypt the metadata that talks about how what's in a bundle differently than the payload itself. Okay, so you've got this thing, you've got this mechanism for getting data across these disrupted networks. How are you gonna provide that support to applications? And this is sort of the trilogy of how you can do that. We did this because we had a lot of confusion come out of this notion of bridging islands of IP, right? If you want to take an IP network and drop it down on the surface of Mars, and you say, well, I want to do that, and then I still want to communicate with it using this disruption-tolerant networking protocol, people will tend to think that DTN is then this ferry that you put your IP packets into, and they go across the vastness of deep space and get to the other end. There are a lot of reasons that doesn't work. Every application, it turns out, has timers in it. If you try to torch up SMTP and over a 15-minute delay, it'll get upset. It'll give up. Even things that you don't think of as being particularly timer-driven tend to have those kinds of things in them. Application layer gateways, I'll talk about a little bit more. The notion here is really you want to provide support to COTS applications. There's a vast wealth of applications that people want to run that they already have that you don't have the access to the source to go change. So obviously the first way says, all right, you take your application and you go modify it to use this different API for DTN. And people look at you and they say, well, no, that's not going to happen. For some things, you can use this gateway approach. And it depends then on whether or not you know what the application layer protocol is doing. So for instance, things like internet relay chat, the server-to-server part of IRC chat typically has a heartbeat in it that runs, you know, on some sub-minute kind of scale. And so if you send a ping message, you don't get a pong message back within some amount of time, or you miss so many of those, then the server drops the TCP connection that it was using, and game over. So the purpose of the application layer gateway in that case is you write something that keeps the application happy. You write one of these gateway applications that sends pong messages. Oh yeah, everything's fine. Don't worry about it. Send me your data. And then the gateway application can pick up the actual IRC traffic off of a TCP connection, dump it down into some of these bundles, and use those across the disrupted piece of the network. And so you can do various chunks of that. You can, in fact, tunnel IP across DTN. It's just a question of what the applications are going to think about that. You know, if you've got an application that's using TCP and suddenly it sees its round trip time go from 10 or 15 milliseconds out to a minute and a half, it's not going to be happy about that. And this was just another example. This was the another example of using gateway applications. But here we did something a little bit different. Instead of with the IRC proxy, we were looking at just how do you get the data out of IRC across one of these disrupted networks. And in the web proxy, we actually took that a step further and said, well, we can do some value added here. You think about trying to, what happens if you try to run HTTP across a disrupted network? Well, you can do the GET, and then you're going to get the base page back, and you've got to, even if you're using 1.1, you've got to go off and get, fetch a bunch of different pages. But you could write a proxy that said, sort of along the lines of the FTP proxy that I talked, or FTP mechanism I talked about earlier, you can say, okay, you can ask for this page, and then I'm going to give you a form that says, what page do you want? Do you want me to go off and crawl that, several levels deep? Because, if you want the front page off CNN.com, maybe you want, two or three levels down from that. And oh, by the way, if your round trip time is, minutes or hours, you're going to get really upset if you have to then click on other links there. And maybe you want to search on, based on keywords or something else. Take all of that and bundle it all together into one of these packages, move that package of requests across the network, and then over on the far side, unpack that request on the connected side of the network and do all the interactive stuff. So you can go off and do and run HTTP over there. You're connected. You can get all the pages. You can do, you can crawl the site several levels deep. You can filter. You can throw stuff out, and then take everything that you got back. Once you've gotten all of those results, build up sort of this web cache nugget. Send that back across the network, and dump it into the near side proxy, and then deliver the pages. So what this ended up being was a system where you could say, I want to see CNN.com and I want to see four levels deep, and either here's what my email address is, or here's my IM name. Tell me when it comes in. So you could send these things off and it would go off, and when somebody decided that they were going to be nice and plug in the cable, then you get the data back, and you get email that says hey. There are a number of places that are looking at deploying, deploying DTN technology. It's flying on the International Space Station. There's a payload onboard the International Space Station, not being used to actually control station. But there's a payload onboard that's using DTN as its main mechanism for sending down telemetry. Yeah. And we've actually got interest there. That's the payload right now is in the NASA module, or the American module, and we've got interest from the Japanese Space Agency and also the Europeans to essentially build up a test bed capability sort of couple between the Earth and the space station and use the payload LAN onboard the space station as the way of interconnecting things. Last year, we flew onboard a deep impact networking flight experiment. This was to a spacecraft that was about 100 light seconds away from Earth. So we were actually able to upload a DTN router code onto the spacecraft and used it as a simulated node in communicating with Mars. So we had a path that went from Earth up to the spacecraft, and we tweaked the routing so that things would go up to the spacecraft and then back down to Earth, and used it to send data. An interesting thing there was we saw recovery from errors that we could never have asked for, right? So in the middle of one of the first passes, when we were running this deep impact experiment, one of the computers in the ground station in the deep space network crashed and rebooted. And you could never ask them to do this for you. We'd like to experiment with what's going to happen if something bad goes wrong in the middle of the pass. No way. But this computer crashed and rebooted, and the custody transfer mechanism, these mechanisms for maintaining reliability in hop-by-hop fashion, kicked in and actually recovered from the error. And it took them a while to figure that out because they weren't expecting things to work that way. One of the other interesting things about station, I said that mission managers are massively conservative. Some of the custody transfer mechanisms that are running between station and the Earth in order to provide the reliability are some of the first things that are actually allowed to flow, protocol mechanisms that flow back up to space station without being checked heavily by humans. Right? Most things, almost anything that goes up that is a command to a spacecraft has got a history of who looked at that command and who pushed the button that actually sent it out. And so for the traffic that we're flowing to station, they've actually got comfortable enough with that after doing the human trick several times to say, okay, we understand that this traffic is just acknowledgments, it's going to be okay, and they allow it to go up with minimal checking from people. And then there's some other interesting parts, connectivity to disadvantaged users. There's an experiment that happens each year in the northern part of Sweden, talking to the Sami community, and here, this is a community of people that don't have the infrastructure. They live too far north to get good geosynchronous satellite coverage. There's not enough of them, and they don't happen to be rich enough that anybody particularly cares about giving them cell tower coverage. And it's a community of essentially nomadic reindeer herders. So these people go off and take care of herds of reindeer throughout the year. And what they do have, though, are snowmobiles. They have snowmobiles, there's some mining activity, they have reindeer, and they have bars. So you say, well, okay, you put a Wi-Fi connection on the back of the snowmobile together with a laptop and something that looks like DTN, and when two snowmobiles get together, you can exchange, you can propagate the newspaper or something, basic news, and get it further out than you can get in a single hop. Scaling in number, as I said, not particularly strong here. There are deployments of DTN that look like hundreds of nodes, not thousands of nodes. The interesting thing to think about here, is the problem with dealing with IP mobility is having to try to maintain this sort of very, very strict and regimented view of the network, right? You're trying to track exactly what the network looks like at all times so that you can forward packets. And what DTN lets you do is it lets you relax that a little bit. It lets you say, look, you don't have to have the answer right now. For some classes of traffic, as long as it's not real-time voice traffic or something that really requires that real-time end-to-end interaction, you're willing to take a little bit of slop in terms of knowing what the network looks like, and you can hold on to that data and get it through later. And so the questions then are, what do you do when people disappear? How do you deal with that? How do you figure out if you think they're going to reappear somewhere else later, are they just gone? And how to manage routing? There's also this culture question. What do you mean? My cell phone is going to be routing your data. Do I trust? Or the converse is, do I trust you to route my data? Right? I'd better be using a lot of those security mechanisms if I'm going to start routing my data through your cell phone, because you can guarantee that people are going to want to see that. And that's it. I left time in this for questions. Thanks to there are whole teams behind each one of these. A lot of these slides were, as I said, were taken from an internal presentation that we put together. DARPA has been very supportive of this, the DTNRG within the IRTF, and also NASA.
So this idea of a store and forward network actually seems pretty cool, so one thing that maybe I missed this or didn't understand or maybe didn't cover it. So what happens if a node actually has ownership of a packet and then that node,
blows
gets
up.
Hit by a meteor or something, right? That seems to imply that not only is that bundle totally lost, but then there isn't even any indication to either the source or the destination that the bundle was lost.
Right. So in the realm of things that we've thought about but haven't actually implemented, right now the notion of custody transfer that we have has a single custodian. So somebody has got custody of that bundle, they're responsible for retransmitting. If they get hit by a meteor, you're toast. It seems like it would be pretty easy to extend that to a rolling, essentially a rolling two custodian, so that you have, two people at any time who are responsible for doing retransmissions, and when something gets to the third guy, you don't tell the previous guy like we do now. You tell the guy who's two behind you, and you could roll things off like that. The other mechanism for dealing with the case where something goes wrong and nobody ever hears of it is in some of the diagnostics. You can inform people, I received this at such a time. You can know what happened to it that way. You can't get it back, right? You really need this notion of either rolling custodians or you could do multipath routing.
Right, and I would guess that would get into issues of, if you're sort of, particularly if you're sort of hanging on to the bundle, on multiple nodes, then you have to worry about, how many you allow that to happen on so you don't get the network all congested with a bunch of stuff that hasn't been delivered yet.
Right.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I was curious, how much work have you done with more terrestrial projects such as LHC and such that need to really move bulk data over potentially congested networks that aren't necessarily, doesn't need to be done in real time, but we really need to, say, get the data from the LHC to Berkeley.
Yeah.
And better utilize existing links at periods of low congestion.
So I haven't done a lot of that. There have been some people that were looking at mainly not sort of the mainstream kinds of applications, but more support for these disadvantaged users, but looking at like replicated file stores over DTN.
Yeah.
And the place where I think that actually has some applicability, where DTN has some applicability there, is mainly as you could use file transfers in a scavenger class, a truly scavenger class that whose job was to get out of the way of all of the interactive traffic that's going on in the network, and only sort of only use the network when it's otherwise lightly loaded. The hop by hop function can get you out of might be able to get you some increased performance if you had a dedicated network for doing that.
Yeah, I think it's rather interesting because it's a really good generic model for like bulk data transfer. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could end up getting, data to Chicago, and the Chicago node decides, I'm never going to get enough bandwidth to Berkeley, so it's easier to, say, put these on hard drives and FedEx them.
Right.
And it would be kind of interesting to extend that.
Right, yeah, yeah. And so, you know, dealing with, and there's another interesting question there, and I didn't get into, you know, a lot of the, you know, what's in the headers, but what do you do if your packet transfer mechanism is a USB key? Right, you know, how do you deal with spinning something off to a USB key, plugging it in somewhere else, having it come up, and deal with things like, well, how old is this? You know, when was this supposed to die? And so, like, one of the things that we have is wall clock time to live that's supposed to say, you know, if you put something on this key and it was supposed to be good for, you know, 20 minutes, but it's 3 days later, you should probably throw it away.
Is there deadline scheduling built into the protocol?
Pardon?
Is there deadline scheduling built into the protocol?
Right.
Yeah.
Sort of related to that or following up on that, something that I never quite understood about this was, there's this premise that we're going to store data in intermediate nodes, and this seems to suggest that this will only work in cases where storage is, quote, cheap, unquote, compared to bandwidth. How big a constraint is that?
So in many cases, that's a good assumption. In some, it's not. The assumption of storage, it's not a requirement that you actually store data in the network using DTN. You're allowed to simply forward things on, even if a bundle is marked for this custody transfer mechanism. You know, we have a notion of who the current custodian is, and that's the person you tell when you take custody, but that might be several hops down the road. So I might be the current custodian for something, transmit to you. If you don't have any storage, you know, all you've got is enough storage to manage the thing in and then back out, you know, you're certainly free to do that without storing it. If you take custody of something, there is this implication that, you know, you're taking responsibility. You really ought to be doing all that you can to ensure that, you know, the thing isn't going to get lost, and that probably means spinning it off to persistent storage somewhere. But you're certainly not required to take custody at each hop.
If I don't take custody, then I act just like a normal IP router, right?
Yeah. And,
okay. In other words, for anything new to happen, there has to be storage in the network.
Pardon?
Otherwise, it just looks like IP.
Pardon?
In other words, for anything new to happen, anything like really characteristically DTN-ish, there has to be storage. Otherwise, everybody just acts like an IP router.
Right. Because otherwise, I mean, otherwise you would have to be able to forward something. If you don't have any storage, you would have to be able to forward everything as soon as you got it. Right. And that's sort of one of the pieces that we're trying to break, you know, by allowing you just to hold on to data.
Gotcha. Thanks.
Hi. This also has to do with the store and forward model. Once you have content with your TTL set long enough that you can assume it's stored in some intermediate node, if you wanted to, say, retransmit the same content, would you be able to address that in some way from the transmit side?
So, you're certainly allowed to, if you have a copy of the data, you're allowed to retransmit it.
Right, but if you as the sender on one end of, you know, the long list of nodes can guarantee that the content's still stored on disk, for example, or somewhere on in an intermediate node, if you wanted to retransmit and while addressing the previous content that you sent already, instead of actually transmitting it again from the beginning, with that, is there some way to address that content, or is that completely transparent to the sender?
I apologize, but I still didn't quite understand that.
Okay, just basically as a form of compression, if you sent a data packet with a fixed content metadata and
right.
You wanted to send another identical packet. And if you can guarantee, based on the time to live of the previous transmitted packet, that some node might still be holding onto it, would you be able to just tell that node?
Oh, I see. Could you simply essentially send like a third party directive that said resend this?
Right.
We don't have a protocol mechanism for doing that. You know, I could see a lot of opportunity for network management to to try to do something like that. The issue there would be knowing exactly who had that data. You know, there's enough in the diagnostics that you can have a good idea of who that is, but in practice that would probably be tough.
Okay, thanks.
Along the same lines, what happens when a packet that gets retransmitted shows up at one of these intermediate nodes that happens to have it queued up waiting for the moon to get out of the way or whatever?
Right. At that point, it's sort of up to the it's up to the implementation to decide what it wants to do with duplicate bundles. The implementation that the IRTF group has will actually go through and scour out duplicate bundles if they happen to, you know, if they happen to show up in the same node. If one node ends up with two copies of a given bundle, it'll scour them out. But it's not particularly smart about if it sees the same thing come through four times, it won't do anything about that.
Okay, so I believe you mentioned that there is some a multiple routing option built in where you can send a packet in multiple directions at the same time, right?
Mm-hmm.
And obviously there's cases like your snowmobile example where you'd want to do that because you don't know which snowmobile is going to get to the base camp first.
Right.
Do you have a way to then flush those out of the queues everywhere? Do you have a broadcast ACK, if you will, use your spare bandwidth every time two snowmobiles get together to say, hey, all of these packets, you can get rid of them.
The kill bundle, right?
Right.
You want the hunter killer bundle to go off and stop other things from happening. No. the thought is, well, so the short answer is no. The thought is that's really hard to do, right? You don't necessarily know what routing decisions were made before on the original bundle. You'd have to somehow keep track of that and be able to find those. And then you have to catch up to it, which might or might not be something that's doable, right? You know, if you've got this highly disrupted network, I might not be able to catch the thing that's three hops ahead of me, regardless. That said, some of the other implementations, there's one by BBN that I think does do something like that. They go off and have, I think, some version of a purge, but I'm not sure.
Okay. So as you mentioned, this really sort of is a concept of making the network smarter than the endpoints in a lot of ways. Yeah. And I think, as I'm thinking about this, the implications of that are still dawning on me. It occurs to me that one of the problems is that if the network has to be aware of application level protocols, then anytime a new protocol comes along, you have to update the entire network in order to be able to handle it. What mechanism, what approach would you take to handle that? How extensible is it? How easy is it to add support, for new protocol, new application level protocols in a DTN network?
Right. So, in this model, the DTN layer, this bundle layer, is serving as a network layer for applications. So you say, I want to deploy this disruption tolerant, almost like an overlay network on top of other stuff, on top of these various transport layers. And that's, in fact, the way that we tend to use DTN, for like the military applications. For the space applications, they run it directly over the link. But in that sense, there's nothing that needs to be done for new applications that come along. They, as long as they write to the DTN API, it is the network layer. It is one thing that doesn't have to change. So you can come along with lots of different applications and not have to swap out anything, in the middle of the network to support them.
Well, but I mean, don't you at least need a way to like encode them in the DTN URLs, URIs, URLs, whatever?
You have to have, right. And so the question there is exactly what does routing mean, right? And that's something that is not well defined yet. But presumably, if you had if the URIs were application specific and contained application specific stuff, yes, you'd be dead, right? Because you'd have to push out, some sort of, you'd either be dead or you'd have to push some quasi active networking thing out into the network to make that happen. But I suspect that that's really not going to be the case for a lot of things. Right, host and port actually tend to get you a really long way. There are lots of people that want to look at things like, you know, I want to send a message to this location, and I want to send it to everybody within like 100 meters of that place, and I want everybody who walks, you know, anybody who happens to walk into that circle to suddenly get it. An interesting thing to be able to do, but it requires that routing support. And so one of the things that needs to happen is to figure out, well, you know, what pieces of that functionality are far enough along and useful enough, you know, to actually develop and deploy.
All right. And if you're saying that DTN is really sort of, you're expecting it to be the application networking layer. So in that case, does that imply that you're sort of envisioning a far future where basically even for terrestrial communication, DTN sits between the application and TCP so that applications don't need to know about both interfaces?
The question is, depending on how well provisioned and how pervasive the terrestrial network is, do you ever need that? Right? If you've got a BlackBerry and your BlackBerry works everywhere, okay, fine. So for a lot of those cases where you have an infrastructure that's one wireless hop away, I think it doesn't necessarily make all that much sense. You could think of, you know, what would happen if you tried to go in and slip, slip this bundle layer on top of sort of all of IP. You'd quickly run into massive problems in scaling.
Well, I was thinking less in terms of you know, actually having it transported over DTN, but more in terms of just what is the API that the application needs to do it, you know, to use to do its networking, right? If every application needs to be written to be able to use both different APIs, and that makes the application code more complicated.
Right.
But if it's just, okay, it uses the DTN API, and then immediately under the hood, that just gets translated to TCP and you know, done the old-fashioned way, that seems like a win for applications.
And modulo the problems with scalability and routing, that, you know, that's certainly possible. There's nothing in DTN that says you have to have delay,
right?
And you know, you could drop directly down, and in fact, you know, almost most, probably all of the implementations will run on top of TCP. So, you know, and at that point, you know, you have another interesting question of, if you're running on top of TCP, you know, who are your neighbors, right? You know, how far can you get, you know, stitching up a single TCP connection? If it's on Earth, you can get pretty far. And at that point, everybody looks like a one-hop neighbor. Well, is that really what you want to do?
Right. Okay, thank you.
Have you learned any particularly useful things from existing store and forward networks or store and forward systems such as the post office or SMTP?
So there was a lot made especially back when we first started, you know, thinking of a Pony Express kind of model for data carriage. And so we sort of tried to base a lot of the early mechanisms on that. So, you know, things like levels of priority, you've got a couple of rather coarse levels of priority that you can assign to things. I think if things like Netflix or some of the other, you know, sort of, you know, bulk transfer kinds of things have been around, there was one, I'm blanking on the name, there was like PostNet, I want to say. There was, you know, somebody had tried to, you thought of an implementation that it was essentially, you know, networking over snail mail. Where
I think Google offered to print out your mail and mail it to you.
Yeah. They'll open all your mail and tell you what's in it. We looked into some of those tried to take what we could. A lot of it was actually more not taken from, you know, existing store and forward systems so much as trying to figure out, you know, how to structure, you know, some of the information so that we could, you know, try to compress out some of these long URI names, things like that.
Just a short follow-up. So there are already times where, say, I have my cell phone, you know, you drive through a part that doesn't have reception, you get back into an area with reception, suddenly, you know, a voicemail shows up. Or,
right.
So this sort of thing already works. How useful is an example like that?
Right. And that's one of the things that we're struggling with. If you have this sort of pervasive infrastructure to support your cell phone, that sort of militates against, you know, trying to go to these sort of heroic measures to try to get you connectivity when you happen to be in the middle of a tunnel and just can't get there right now. You know, why are you going to try to route through somebody else's phone to get out of the tunnel? For some of these other applications, you know, you don't have the infrastructure. I agree that it's a hard sell to say, you know, you should think about, you know, what's going to happen if you rip out all of, you know, the Earth's infrastructure and replace it with DTN. You know, an interesting thing to think about, but, you know, again, if you've got this pervasive infrastructure, I can turn on wireless, and presumably if wireless were working, get out easily.
I was curious to hear what thoughts, if any, you guys have given towards DTN's version of ICMP. You know, discovering not only like firing forget, you know, get this to them if you see them, but do we physically have a route to this particular node? Have we ever? When was the last time they were seen? Who still has custody of this particular payload? That kind of thing.
So those are sort of, I think those are different questions, right? One, right. So there are notions of status reports of bundles that you can use to try to generate some information about where things have gone and what's happened with them, like who took custody of this thing when. And you can cause those reports to go to a third party. So you can be the sender, and you can say, I'm going to launch this bundle, and everybody who takes custody of it, I want you to tell this guy over here, because I don't want to know about it. In terms of things like neighbor discovery, you know, who's your neighbor? You know, that starts to get really interesting, because you know you have this problem of, especially when you think of wireless and tactical environments. If I'm running over TCP, well, everybody can be my neighbor, right? I can hit people that are, you know, 15 hops away. But is it really a good idea to do that? You know, it goes back to the, you know, if I'm trying to move this file from Chicago to Berkeley, you know, I might be able to do that, but if the individual links in that chain are ratty, you know, there's a trade that I can make that says, you know, I could find people that are 15 IP hops away from me, but the reliability goes down with distance. And at some point, it's better for me to say, you know, it's better to not go further, to take the guy that's 4 hops away from me and let him relay it for me. That's about as far as we've gone in terms of, sort of the network management ICMP kinds of traffic, really. You know, there are notions of how to do neighbor discovery. None of it has been, only the very basics of it have even made it to internet drafts.
I just wanted to thank you for the work you're doing here. I am interested in informatics and, you know, taking the internet to areas that don't have it, or looking at using not stimulus money on fiber loading up very rural neighborhoods, but putting wireless on, say, the mail truck that goes mm-hmm. through every day, or on community buses that drive through and do that. And so we can look at the issue of the challenges we have today as internet citizens, where we are so connected, where we have this terrestrial network implies that we can always connect to Google, that we can always, you know, that Twitter is always up. And so, you know, as long as now you've got this layer that we don't have to think about, we can use the same technology to get to Mars that we can use out in very rural, middle America type things, third world things.
Right.
And then just worry about how we do caching web things and think about, we can do Google Voice, we could do delayed searches and worry about that kind of buffering and not have to worry about the stuff in the middle. So that's very cool. Thank you.
This was motivated when we went back to DARPA the second time. It was actually Vince Cerf and another one of my colleagues from MITRE went back and pitched this. And they went back to the PI there and said, oh, we have this great idea for doing this. And we got lucky in a sense in that he was running several different programs that were dealing with things like unattended ground sensors and things that were not, you know, not well connected. And he looked out and said, well, so here's the deal. You know, lots of, you know, this isn't hard to do. Right, you know, lots of you can easily sit down and in, you know, an hour think of, you know, how would I build a system that would send this data across multiple hops. And the problem is lots and lots of people did this. And what the program manager at DARPA saw was this was Preston Marshall at the time, was that he had, you know, 8 programs and like 6 of them were doing something like this. But it wasn't their primary job. Right, their primary job was building unattended ground sensors, and yeah, they had to get the data out. But you know, okay, you know, we'll find some way to make that happen. And so part of the goal was at the time, you know, was to try to build this infrastructure layer and you know push this common service down, you know, into the network so that it could be shared by a number of different applications and leveraged.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.